Chapter 78. Thus an almost reconciliation was brought about between the brothers. When Rebecca came to town, Pitt and his wife were not in London. Many a time she drove by the old door in Park Lane to see whether they had taken possession of Miss Crawley's house there. But the new family did not make its appearance. It was only through Raggles that she heard of their movements, how Miss Crawley's domestics had been dismissed with decent gratuities, and how Mr. Pitt had only once made his appearance in London, when he stopped for a few days at the house, did business with his lawyers there, and sold off all Miss Crawley's French novels to a bookseller out of Bond Street. Becky had reasons of her own which caused her to long for the arrival of her new relation. When Lady Jane comes, thought she shall be my sponsor in London society, and as for the women, bah, the women will ask me when they find the men want to see me. An article as necessary to a lady in this position as her brougham or her bouquet is her companion. I have always admired the way in which the tender creatures, who cannot exist without sympathy, hire an exceedingly plain friend of their own sex from whom they are almost inseparable. The sight of that inevitable woman, in her faded gown seated behind her dear friend in the opera box, or occupying the back seat of the barouche, is always a wholesome and moral one to me, as jolly a reminder as that of the death's head which figured in the repasts of Egyptian bon vivants, a strange sardonic memorial of Vanity Fair. What? Even battered, brazen, beautiful, conscienceless, heartless, Mrs. Firebrace, whose father died of her shame. Even lovely, daring Mrs. Mantrap, who will ride at any fence which any man in England will take, and who drives her greys in the park, while her mother keeps a huckster's stall in Bath. Still, even those who are so bold, one might fancy they could face anything, dare not face the world without a female friend. They must have somebody to cling to, the affectionate creatures. And you will hardly see them in any public place without a shabby companion in a dyed silk, sitting somewhere in the shade close behind them. Rawdon, said Becky, very late one night, as a party of gentlemen were seated round her crackling drawing-room fire, for the men came to her house to finish the night, and as he had ice and coffee for them, the best in London, Colin must have a sheepdog. A what? Said Rawdon, looking up from an eager table. A sheepdog, said young Lord Southdown. Why, dear Mrs. Crawley, what a fancy. Why not have a Danish dog? I know of one as big as a camel leopard, by Jove. It would almost pull your brougham. Or a Persian greyhound, eh? I propose, if you please, or a little pug, that would go into one of Lord Steyne's snuff boxes. There's a man at Bayswater, got one with such a nose, that you might I mark the king and play, that you might hang your hat on it. I mark the trick, Rawdon gravely said. He attended to his game commonly, and didn't much meddle with the conversation, except when it was about horses and betting. What can you want with a shepherd's dog? The lively little Southdown continued. I mean a moral shepherd's dog, said Becky, laughing, and looking up at Lord Steyne. What the devil's that? Said his lordship. A dog to keep the wolves off me, Rebecca continued. A companion. Dear little innocent lamb, you want one, said the Marquis, and his jaw thrust out, and he began to grin hideously, his little eyes leering towards Rebecca. The great Lord of Steyne was standing by the fire sipping coffee. The fire crackled and blazed pleasantly. There was a score of candles sparkling round the mantelpiece, in all sorts of quaint sconces, of gilt and bronze and porcelain. They lighted up Rebecca's figure to admiration, as she sat on a sofa covered with a pattern of gaudy flowers. She was in a pink dress, that looked as fresh as a rose. Her dazzling white arms and shoulders were half covered with a thin hazy scarf through which they sparkled. Her hair hung in curls round her neck. One of her little feet peeped out from the fresh crisp folds of the silk. The prettiest little foot in the prettiest little sandal in the finest silk stocking in the world. The candles lighted up Lord Steyne's shining bald head, which was fringed with red hair. He had thick bushy eyebrows, with little twinkling bloodshot eyes, surrounded by a thousand wrinkles. His jaw was underhung, and when he laughed, two white buck teeth protruded themselves, and glistened savagely in the midst of the grin. He had been dining with royal personages, and wore his garter and ribbon. A short man was his lordship, broad-chested and bow-legged, but proud of the fineness of his foot and ankle, and always caressing his garter knee. "And so the shepherd is not enough," said he, "to defend his lambkin? The shepherd is too fond of playing at cards and going to his clubs," answered Becky, laughing. "Gad, what a debauched Corydon," said my lord, "had a mouth for a pipe. I take your 3-2-2, here," said Rawdon, "at the card table." "Hark at Melibius," snarled the noble marquis, "he's pastorally occupied too. He's shearing a south down. What an innocent mutton, hey? Damn, what a snowy fleece." Rebecca's eyes shot out gleams of scornful humor. "My lord," she said, "you are a knight of the order." He had the collar round his neck, indeed a gift of the restored princes of Spain. Lord Stang in early life had been notorious for his daring and his success at play. He had sat up 2 days and 2 nights with Mr. Fox at hazard. He had won money of the most august personages of the realm. He had won his marquisate, it was said, at the gaming table, but he did not like an allusion to those bygone Fredanes. Rebecca saw the scowl gathering over his heavy brow. She rose up from her sofa and went and took his coffee cup out of his hand with a little curtsy. "Yes," she said, "I must get a watchdog. But he won't bark at you." And, going into the other drawing room, she sat down to the piano and began to sing little French songs in such a charming, thrilling voice that the mollified nobleman speedily followed her into that chamber and might be seen nodding his head and bowing time over her. Rawdon and his friend meanwhile played Eckard until they had enough. The colonel won, but, say that he won ever, so much and often, nights like these, which occurred many times in the week, his wife having all the talk and all the admiration, and he sitting silent without the circle, not comprehending a word of the jokes, the allusions, the mystical language within, must have been rather wearisome to the ex-dragoon. "How is Mrs. Crawley's husband?" Lord Stang used to say to him by way of a good day when they met, and indeed that was now his avocation in life. He was Colonel Crawley no more. He was Mrs. Crawley's husband. About the little Rawdon, if nothing has been said all this while, it is because he is hidden upstairs in a garret somewhere, or has crawled below into the kitchen for companionship. His mother scarcely ever took notice of him. He passed the days with his French bonne, as long as that domestic remained in Mr. Crawley's family, and when the Frenchwoman went away, the little fellow, howling in the loneliness of the night, had compassion taken on him by a housemaid, who took him out of his solitary nursery into her bed in the garret hard by and comforted him. Rebecca, my Lord Stang, and one or two more were in the drawing room taking tea after the opera, when this shouting was heard overhead. "'Tis my cherub crying for his nurse," she said. She did not offer to move to go and see the child. "Aunt, agitate your feelings by going to look for him," said Lord Stang sardonically. "Bah," replied the other, with a sort of blush, "he'll cry himself to sleep." And they fell to talking about the opera. Rawdon had stolen off, though, to look after his son and heir, and came back to the company when he found that honest Dolly was consoling the child. The colonel's dressing room was in those upper regions. He used to see the boy there in private. They had interviews together every morning when he shaved, Rawdon Minor sitting on a box by his father's side, and watching the operation with never-ceasing pleasure. He and the sire were great friends. The father would bring him sweetmeats from the dessert, and hide them in a certain old epaulet box, where the child went to seek them, and laughed with joy on discovering the treasure, laughed, but not too loud. For Mama was below asleep, and must not be disturbed. She did not go to rest till very late, and seldom rose till afternoon. Rodden bought the boy plenty of picture books and crammed his nursery with toys. Its walls were covered with pictures pasted up by the father's own hand and purchased by him for ready money. When he was off duty with Mrs. Rodden in the park, he would sit up here, passing hours with the boy, who rode on his chest, who pulled his great mustachios, as if they were driving reins, and spent days with him in indefatigable gambols. The room was a low room, and once, when the child was not 5 years old, his father, who was tossing him wildly up in his arms, hit the poor little chap's skull so violently against the ceiling that he almost dropped the child, so terrified was he at the disaster. Rodden Minor had made up his face for a tremendous howl. The severity of the blow indeed authorized that indulgence. But just as he was going to begin, the father interposed. "For God's sake, Roddy, don't wake Mama," he cried. And the child, looking in a very hard and piteous way at his father, bit his lips, clenched his hands, and didn't cry a bit. Rodden told that story at the clubs, at the mess, to everybody in town. "Why, gad, sir," he explained to the public in general, "what a good plucked one that boy of mine is, what a trump he is. I half sent his head through the ceiling, by gad, and he wouldn't cry for fear of disturbing his mother." Sometimes once or twice in a week, that lady visited the upper regions in which the child lived. She came like a vivified figure out of the magazine des modes, blandly smiling in the most beautiful new clothes and little gloves and boots. Wonderful scarfs, laces, and jewels glittered about her. She had always a new bonnet on, and flowers bloomed perpetually in it, or else magnificent curling ostrich feathers, soft and snowy as camellias. She nodded twice or thrice patronizingly to the little boy, who looked up from his dinner, or from the pictures of soldiers he was painting. When she left the room, an odor of rose, or some other magical fragrance, lingered about the nursery. She was an unearthly being in his eyes, superior to his father to all the world, to be worshipped and admired at a distance. To drive with that lady in the carriage was an awful rite. He sat up in the back seat and did not dare to speak. He gazed with all his eyes at the beautifully dressed princess opposite to him. Gentlemen on splendid prancing horses came up and smiled and talked with her. How her eyes beamed upon all of them! Her hand used to quiver and wave gracefully as they passed. When he went out with her, he had his new red dress on. His old brown shawl, and was good enough when he stayed at home. Sometimes, when she was away, and Dolly his maid was making his bed, he came into his mother's room. It was as the abode of a fairy to him, a mystic chamber of splendor and delights. There in the wardrobe hung those wonderful robes, pink and blue and many-tinted. There was the jewel case, silver-clasped, and the wondrous bronze hand on the dressing table, glistening all over with 100 rings. There was the cheval glass, that miracle of art, in which he could just see his own wondering head, and the reflection of Dolly queerly distorted, and as if up in the ceiling, plumping and patting the pillows of the bed. "Oh, thou poor lonely little benighted boy. Mother is the name for God in the lips and hearts of little children, and here was one who was worshipping a stone." Now Rodden Crawley, rascal as the colonel was, had certain manly tendencies of affection in his heart, and could love a child and a woman still. For Rodden Minor he had a great secret tenderness then, which did not escape Rebecca, though she did not talk about it to her husband. It did not annoy her. She was too good-natured. It only increased her scorn for him. He felt somehow ashamed of this paternal softness, and hid it from his wife, only indulging in it when alone with the boy. He used to take him out of mornings, when they would go to the stables together, and to the park. "Little Lord Southdown, the best-natured of men, who would make you a present of the hat from his head, and whose main occupation in life was to buy knick-knacks, that he might give them away afterwards, bought the little chap a pony not much bigger than a large rat," the donor said, "and on this little black Shetland pygmy young Rodden's great father was pleased to mount the boy, and to walk by his side in the park. It pleased him to see his old quarters, and his old fellow guardsmen at Knightsbridge. He had begun to think of his bachelorhood with something like regret. The old troopers were glad to recognize their ancient officer and dandle the little colonel. Colonel Crawley found dining at mess, and with his brother officers very pleasant. Hang it, I ain't clever enough for her, I know it. She won't miss me, he used to say. And he was right, his wife did not miss him. Rebecca was fond of her husband. She was always perfectly good-humored and kind to him. She did not even show her scorn much for him. Perhaps she liked him the better for being a fool. He was her upper servant and made her dawdle. He went on her errands, obeyed her orders without question, drove in the carriage in the ring with her without repining, took her to the opera box, solaced himself at his club during the performance, and came punctually back to fetch her when due. He would have liked her to be a little fonder of the boy, but even to that he reconciled himself. Agnet, you know she's so clever, he said, and I'm not literary and that, you know. For, as we have said before, it requires no great wisdom to be able to win at cards and billiards, and Rawdon made no pretensions to any other sort of skill. When the companion came, his domestic duties became very light. His wife encouraged him to dine abroad. She would let him off duty at the opera. Aunt, stay and stupefy yourself at home tonight, my dear, she would say. Oh, men are coming who will only bore you. I would not ask them, but you know it's for your good, and now I have a sheepdog, I need not be afraid to be alone. A sheepdog, a companion. Becky Sharp with a companion. Isn't it good fun? Thought Mrs. Crawley to herself. The notion tickled hugely her sense of humor. One Sunday morning, as Rod and Crawley, his little son, and the pony were taking their accustomed walk in the park, they passed by an old acquaintance of the colonel's, Corporal Klink, of the regiment, who was in conversation with a friend, an old gentleman, who held a boy in his arms about the age of little Rodden. This other youngster had seized hold of the Waterloo medal which the corporal wore, and was examining it with delight. Good morning, Your Honor, said Klink, in reply to the "How do, Klink?" of the colonel. His ear young gentleman is about the little colonel's age, sir, continued the corporal. His father was a Waterloo man too, said the old gentleman, who carried the boy. Asked he, Georgie? Yes, said Georgie. He and the little chap on the pony were looking at each other with all their might, solemnly scanning each other as children do. In a line regiment, Klink said with a patronizing air. He was a captain in the TH regiment, said the old gentleman rather pompously. Captain George Osborne, sir, perhaps you knew him. He died the death of a hero, sir, fighting against the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.